In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Tuesday, November 25th, 2014. You Tolkien fans are in for a treat today. But even if you're not, you're going to enjoy this conversation with Jay Richards, co-author of The Hobbit Party, The Vision of Freedom That Tolkien Got and the West Forgot. This episode is brought to you by Audible, where you can get a free copy of the audiobook version of The Hobbit. Help yourself to that free audiobook at tomwoodsaudio.com. Jay Richards is a New York Times best-selling author and an assistant research professor in the School of Business and Economics at the Catholic University of America. Jay, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much, Tom, for having me.
This is a very interesting book. I finished it up last night, The Hobbit Party. And as I told you before we went on, I'm not all that knowledgeable. I mean, I read The Hobbit in middle school, and
right.
I've seen the Lord of the Rings movies, and there is the extent of my knowledge. So I'm going to need you to pull me along in terms of the literary aspect, but some of the themes that you're pulling out of this are perennial and interesting to anybody listening. I'm sure we have a lot of fans of these works in my audience, but the themes that you raise are certainly very interesting. First of all, let's tell us about Tolkien himself. Tell us about the author and his own views, not as expressed through his literature, but as we've been able to glean through interviews and other sources in which he's speaking in his own voice.
Absolutely. I mean, J.R. Tolkien was actually a prominent scholar of the English language at Oxford University. He was a very Orthodox Catholic. People that know anything about Tolkien know that, but if you just know Tolkien from his fantasy novels, you might not realize it because his sort of Catholic worldview doesn't come across explicitly in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. But as you mentioned, we have extensive records of his private correspondence over a period of decades. He wrote to his son throughout World War II and all the way from, you know, the 1920s up until, you know, he died in 1973. And so we know what Tolkien's actual ideas and views are, and what we, Jonathan Witt and I, who my co-author with the book The Hobbit Party, realize is a lot of people don't realize how rich his political and economic ideas are, the way they inform his literature, and the particular views he has. Insofar as there have been books written about Tolkien's political and economic views, they've been mostly misguided because Tolkien says so much that appeals to people at a kind of an intuitive level. They often don't go and say, okay, what did this man actually think? But what you discover if you study him, and especially his private writings, is you find a very serious Catholic, a very serious intellectual who had important things to say about power, political power, economics, and things that might seem kind of far afield from his fantasy novels, but actually have something direct to do with them.
I can't resist quoting a quotation that you use on page 25 of your book. He's quoted as saying that his, quote, political opinions lean more and more to anarchy, philosophically understood, meaning abolition of control, not whiskered men with bombs. And then he goes on to say, the most improper job of any man, even saints, is bossing other men. Not one in a million is fit for it, and least of all those who seek the opportunity. Comment?
That's a perfect distillation of his view. And again, this is just a private letter, I believe, to his son Christopher, sort of later in life. But anyone that, of course, reads The Lord of the Rings, you know this kind of, this, in some ways, the main character, at least the main antagonist, is this ring of absolute power, which the bad guys the worst guy in The Lord of the Rings is this creature Sauron has created this ring both to extend his own power across Middle-earth and also to ensnare others who might come across it. What's interesting about Lord of the Rings is it's structurally it's like a classic quest narrative. A quest narrative is just where you have the protagonist going on a quest. They're, you know, going to find something, a great treasure or something like that. But in The Lord of the Rings, they're not trying to find the ring. They're trying to rid the world of it. And it's because it's this source of malevolent power. And it's not just sort of power in a generic sense. It's power to dominate the will of others. And when people try to use it, yeah, they might acquire some of that power, but they also find themselves dominated by that power. And so the good guys in the Lord of the Rings are trying to get rid of this. And this is, I mean, it's central to the Lord of the Rings, and as listeners could tell just from this quote, it's central to Lewis's own view. He was skeptical of centralized political power, even of the you know, people on his side. He was a lifelong Tory so far as we know, but he still, you know, was squeamish about the way in which power became more and more centralized in his own Great Britain. And, you know, it's central to his novels. It's central to his political ideas. And so, you know, in terms of an author that has reflected on the dangers of coercive power, there aren't very many other than J.R.R. Tolkien that I think did it more extensively and more completely.
Now, I know that from at least what little I know, that Tolkien was not a fan of message books, you know, where the fiction was conveying such an express message that it overwhelmed the literary merit of the work. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine what he would think of Ayn Rand novels, which have their pleasures, but a 40-page speech is not something that would appear in a book like this. But nevertheless, he is, as you say, he is nevertheless conveying important ideas through these books, but not in a sledgehammer style. Now, how do we know?
That's right.
Can we know through his own private letters and commentary and interviews, can we know that he was deliberately aiming to make particular points to people when he wrote these works?
Well, here's how he put it, Tom, because he didn't like, as you implied there, he didn't like allegory. He didn't like books
Thing represents this and that represents that, and it
could just be
and you just get a little decoder and then you understand the book.
That's right. He hated that stuff. And so people, when Lord of the Rings came out in the 50s, they started saying, oh, well, the ring represents the atomic bomb, and they sort of tie it one piece to another piece to current events. He said, no. He said, I've cordially disliked allegory from the age in which I first learned to recognize that these books aren't allegory in that sense. Nevertheless, they have what he said is applicability. That is, they apply to current issues, and they apply because he's exploring perennial and universal themes, the question of power, virtue, and goodness, when is it okay to exercise violence and self-defense. All these questions are perennial themes, and precisely because he wasn't writing these books as allegories of the 1940s or the 1950s, they're actually much more applicable to our own situation in here at the 21st century. And in many ways, when you read them, you think, my word, they might as well have been written last week. And so it's always important both to say, yes, he did not intend these as allegory. You're going to misunderstand them if you do that. But he also quite clearly understood them to apply to the issues of the day. And he tells us that in the letters. He even makes this point about allegory and applicability in the foreword to later editions of The Lord of the Ring.
Well, this point about coercive power and his squeamishness about it and his dislike for it, let's say, how does that come through, other than the obvious point that the ring in the hands of, well, I was about to say in the hands of the wrong people, in the hands of any people, is mm-hmm. bound to lead to all kinds of undesirable results and surely will involve the use of coercive power. But what else? Are there any more subtle ways in which we can see his views on this in either in The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings, etc.?
Absolutely. In fact, if you read The Lord of the Rings, in many ways, his views of these sort of bookend, the beginning and end of this three-volume set that we call The Lord of the Rings. And so at the very beginning, when you read it, he tells us about hobbits. He tells us about the Shire, and there's a little section about the Shire, about the hobbits. And of course, the Shire, for those who haven't read the books or seen the movies, is it just this sort of bucolic pastoral place where most of these little characters, the hobbits, live. And he tells us about the Shire. He says, in those days, the Shire had hardly any government. Hobbits and families mostly just attended to their own affairs. In fact, the only kind of visible presence of what you might call the state were these sheriffs who didn't even bother to wear uniforms, and their main job was just to sort of, if somebody, you know, keep people's, the boundaries of people's property clear. So if somebody's, you know, sheep wandered into somebody else's pasture, the sheriffs would move them back to where they were supposed to go. And then you come to the end of The Lord of the Rings. One of the last chapters is called The Scouring of the Shire. And you don't see this in the movie. Peter Jackson was able to excise it. But this is after the ring has been destroyed, Sauron has, and his, you know, his evil kingdom have been destroyed, and the good guys and the hobbits return to the Shire, and the bad guy, a wizard named Saruman, his still life, he's managed to get some toady hobbits, and they've overrun the Shire. They've cut down the party tree, they put people in jail, they build all these ugly smoke sacks, they've created essentially a police state, and the hobbits have to fight to retrieve the Shire from Saruman and his toady. And so you have a vision at the beginning of the sort of idyllic small government situation, actually very little government in the Shire at the beginning, and then what every Tolkien interpreter agrees is a sort of critique of the kind of socialism, even the soft socialism you saw in Great Britain after World War II when you get to the Scouring of the Shire. That's the beginning and the end of the book. And so, while again, it's not an allegory about politics, it's very difficult not to see that this obviously has something to do with this issue about the role of centralized government in coercive power.
Let's switch gears. I want to talk about something that has been a source of controversy regarding the book already, and I love controversy, especially on a topic where I have strong opinions. And there are very few topics where I don't. But on the subject of localism, now it's one thing to say that he believes in localism. I mean, I like localism depending on how you define it. But what some have said is that he was really a distributist and that you are trying to force him more into a traditional conservative slash libertarian mold that would be familiar to us in the 21st century, but he was more a throwback to the ideas of G.K. Chesterton and distributism. First of all, explain to people what distributism is. I have a whole chapter against distributism in my book, The Church and the Market, for anybody who wants read about it. But tell people what it is and then explain why Tolkien isn't.
Absolutely. Distributism, part of the problem is it's kind of hard to define, as you know, Tom.
It is.
It's really associated with British Catholic intellectuals in the early 20th century, G.K. Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc, who were great writers and intellectuals on many things, but they advocated an idea that is they called distributism. It was essentially, at bottom, it was a desire for there to be what they called widespread distribution of productive property. And so when you put it that way as a kind of aspiration, it sounds great. The problem is that when you actually look at the details that, say, Hilaire Belloc proposed in his essay on the restoration of property, you get what I call the distributist paradox. And so you want there to be widespread distribution of productive property. You identify productive property as essentially capital and land, and you look around and say, well, most people don't have, as Chesterton said, you know, 3 acres and a cow. So what are you going to do? What policy are you going to implement in order to make that happen? Well, it was clear, if you read Belloc, but what you do is you have the state make its constant business to tax companies after they get above a certain size, to create guilds, which are essentially cartels that will control the price of labor, and the government just continually, essentially confiscates private property when people get too much and redistributes it. And so it's really a paradox, because Belloc and Chesterton's goal was to have a small state and widespread distribution of both property and power. But the only way that they could figure out how to do that would be to give the centralized state more or less absolute power over people's private property. And so this is why I think at an aspirational level, of course you want property to be widely distributed. I think it's a mistake to identify productive property in the, you know, even in the 20th century with farms and land and things like that. But I think as a political program, it's just fraught with problems. Now, clearly, Chesterton and Belloc and some who follow him continue to advocate this. They're contemporary distributists that are trying to sort of fix the problems. And we didn't want to get into the whole debate about distributism.
Right.
So much as we wanted to address this question of whether Tolkien was a distributist, because there are a number of prominent Tolkien scholars that we respect who have argued that. We, years ago, actually thought this was true until we got into Tolkien. But what's interesting is, as you can already imagine from the things we've talked about, Tolkien was extremely skeptical of the use of centralized sort of coercive power of government, even for laudable goals. And so we are absolutely certain that he never would have signed off on Hilaire Belloc's program to have the government make its routine business to continually confiscate and redistribute property. Tolkien just would not have gone in for that. But more obviously, he never went to a distributist meeting. He never, so far as we know, even uttered the word distributism. He never identified with them in any way, even though, of course, he knew of Belloc and Chesterton's writings and mostly appreciated them. So in many ways, it's a sort of the case of the dog not barking. If you're going to identify Tolkien as a distributist, surely we should have some direct evidence that he identified with those ideas. But, you know, yes, he liked it. He sort of was fond of the idea of farms and of localism of a certain sort, but that doesn't make you a distributist any more than it makes you or me a distributist. And so we just think this is one example where otherwise sympathetic conservative Catholic scholars have interpreted, or really I think misinterpreted, Tolkien and put him in a category where he really doesn't fit. And Jonathan Witt and I, we just really think that Tolkien ought to be taken on his own terms. He does not get a fit neatly into 21st century American politics, but if you try to cram him into the pigeonhole of distributism, I think you fail to understand the subtleness and the richness of his thinking.
Jay, before we continue, I just want to make sure I'm remembering this correctly. Did I read that you and your co-author Jonathan Witt have been friends since grade school?
That's right. In fact, we have known each other since the first grade. Part of the time we'd be in the same school together, part of the time we weren't. And so we actually read The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings at the sixth and the seventh grades initially. And so we've known each other for a long time. Jonathan is actually a literary scholar. His PhD is in literary criticism. We've done projects together, documentaries, and edited each other's works, but we had never done a book together. And so this one had been sort of bothering us for years because we thought people didn't understand Tolkien as well as they ought to. And honestly, we realized, okay, now there are three Hobbit movies. If we can't manage to get this book out before the third Hobbit movie comes out, you know, that's really lame. So that's sort of, you know, the Hobbit movie comes out here on December 17th. So we managed to make the self-imposed deadline.
All right. Well, that's good. That's good. We have to say something about the theology of all this. On the surface of it, it looks, as you say in the book, as if the people in these stories are really noble pre-Christian pagans, because there is no quote-unquote religion in the story.
Right.
But then when you read Tolkien speaking privately, I can't recall what work he was criticizing, but he thought that the Christianity of it was so in your face that it ruined the whole story. That what you do in a case like this is you don't say, and this is the Christ figure, and this is the, you weave it into the fabric of the tale, the fabric of the characters, the setting. It's part of what you're describing. It's part of the world, but it's not a separate entity.
That's right. And that's what he did in Lord of the Rings. And I think this is why people are often sort of misled if they just read The Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit and they don't have a kind of theological background. What he didn't want to do, because he was a very serious Catholic, he's writing fantasy novels that are, you know, you can imagine this being in the kind of prehistoric Earth or something, these civilizations that emerged before we started marking history. He didn't want to, obviously he couldn't have them be Christians, but he didn't want to create another religion that they were adhering to, because then it would seem to compete with his own Catholic worldview. And so he just essentially embeds it in the narrative itself. And in some ways, it's sort of encoded. And you don't realize this unless you go read his other work called The Silmarillion, which he never really actually finally published. His son took multiple versions of The Silmarillion after his father's death and edited them. And it was finally released in 1977, 4 years after J.R.R. Tolkien had died. The Silmarillion is essentially his giant mythology that he had built from the ground up, that is the sort of mythological background to the stories that people are familiar with. If you open up the Silmarillion, and on the very first page, you get a creation event. There is a transcendent god named Ilúvatar who creates the entire world. He creates these great, essentially these archangels who then he allows to help participate in sort of creating the rest of the world. And even, for instance, the wizards, the beloved Gandalf, They're actually these kind of mid-level archangels, and Tolkien described them as called the Maiar, but he described them as essentially incarnate angels. And so there is actually a whole explicit theology, but it's built into the warp and woof of the stories, and so you don't see any direct sort of overt religion that you'd recognize in the novels. And so in many ways, I think it was a really a great thing that he did, because people that otherwise might actually be off-put by Christianity or theology end up falling in love with these stories. And I think those that continue to go deeper discover that many of the things they loved richly theological ideas, and they just didn't recognize what it was. And so I think in some ways, as a Catholic, I think Tolkien it sort of creates an interesting pre-apologetic or pre-evangelistic opportunity, because it's just so much of his Catholic worldview finds his way into these stories.
All right, give me an example of a way in which the Catholic worldview is part of the story, and again, not in the crude way that you might expect in some modern literature, but in the more subtle and way that a real craftsman might do it.
Absolutely. Just think of the hobbits themselves, and compare the stories that you know from, say, some pre-Christian Rome or pre-Christian Greece. The Greeks or Homer, they would never have thought to make the great hero of a story a small, slight, humble creature called hobbits, right, who walk around on bare feet. They work in their gardens in the dirt. They're just the sort of embodiment of humility and powerlessness in many ways, and yet they become, precisely because of their humility, they become the heroes. It's only hobbits that are ever able to carry the ring for any amount of time without quickly falling under the domination of the ring. And this is a Christian idea, this idea that humility, that the transcendent creator of the universe could become incarnate and be born of a peasant woman. That is a very specifically Christian idea, that power and goodness, and the goodness and power of the Creator, could find itself manifest in the most humble of circumstances, the most humble of creatures. And that's what Tolkien does in the novels. We're all drawn to that, but that would be very counterintuitive to a pre-Christian Greek writing heroic literature. This is just not the appropriate kind of hero. And yet Tolkien, who had taken fully on board the Christian virtue of humility, was able to create a character that is in many ways more appealing to modern people than the sort of heroic stories of old. And so, in many ways, of course, Lord of the Rings is a heroic tale in which you have great heroes like Aragorn and the wizard Gandalf. Nevertheless, the real hero of the story is this humble hobbit named Frodo Baggins in Lord of the Rings. That wouldn't happen. That would not have occurred literarily, I think, to someone that had not at least drunk deeply at the Christian worldview.
Last thing I want to talk to you about is, because I want people to read it, because this is a wonderful glimpse really inside Tolkien's mind, but also it takes you more deeply into these literary works that so many people love. The last issue I want to talk about involves your discussion in here of Rousseau. Because Jean-Jacques Rousseau was a bit of an outlier in the Enlightenment, because he was not of the view that we had linear progress in civilization. To the contrary, perhaps civilization itself is not progress. Perhaps there is something to be said for the natural man before these various institutions develop that make him somewhat artificial. How does the work of Tolkien reflect on this? Because, of course, he's been associated, lumped in with Rousseau, as if he's taking a Rousseauian position here.
He's not at all. And so, I mean, Tolkien never, Rousseau sort of had to imagine that man, purely in his natural state, the kind of Robinson Crusoe character, would be sort of the noble savage. And of course, cultures and states can do very bad things to human beings. But Tolkien's view is that no, humans are also naturally social creatures. We find ourselves initially born into families. We don't just drop out of heaven into the jungle. We naturally have voluntary associations that we build up, and those things enculturate us and they civilize us. We are civilized by the church and the body of Christ. And that was sort of Tolkien's much more rich Christian view. The other thing is that he was continued to be skeptical. He would have been utterly skeptical of the idea of the noble savage, simply because that even the noble savage would be a descendant of Adam. He would still be fallen. He would still tend to want to acquire power and to exercise injustice. And so Tolkien always avoids the kind of utopian fantasies, and he does it in The Lord of the Rings. Just when you think, okay, finally the good guys have won, they vanquished the bad guys, then you get the scouring of the Shire here right at the end. It seems almost anticlimactic, but Tolkien wanted to say, look, we, this side of paradise, we live in a fallen world. We can hope for better situations. We can fight on the side of justice and against evil, but don't expect utopia this side of the kingdom of God. He does that both at the end of The Lord of the Rings and to a lesser extent at the end of The Hobbit, when Bilbo comes back from his adventures, shows up at the Shire, and he's been declared dead, and all of his conniving cousins and neighbors are essentially confiscating and divvying up his property. And so Tolkien was fundamentally sort of anti-utopian. He did believe in the intrinsic goodness of creation and the material world, but he believed in a world that was both good but also fallen and in need of redemption. And holding all those things together would just have been very hard to do without a kind of Christian perspective on things.
Well, the book is The Hobbit Party, The Vision of Freedom That Tolkien Got and the West Forgot, by Jonathan Witt and my guest, Jay Richards. Jay, best of luck with this. I guess Amazon is where you would direct people to go grab a copy?
Absolutely. I hope they'll go to Amazon. And if they like the book, please feel free to give Amazon a review.
And, of course, you can help us both out. You can help out the Tom Woods Show by entering Amazon through the Amazon widget on the show page, tomwoodsradio.com. And then help out Jonathan Witt and Jay Richards by buying yourself a copy in time for the release of the third movie. Jay, thanks for your time today.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, everybody. The book is The Hobbit Party. Check it out on Amazon. And remember, you can get The Hobbit itself in audiobook form for free via tomwoodsaudio.com. Thanksgiving is coming, so remember, you can get my wife's foolproof juicy turkey recipe. No more dry turkey. We talked to her a year ago on this show at Thanksgiving, and I've got a link to her blog post with a lot of pictures showing you how to make a moist turkey every time. So it would be hard to link you to that blog post because it's in a long URL. So just go to tomwoods.com/turkey, and you will be thanking me, my friends. Remember, we give you a daily serving of Liberty education here on The Tom Woods Show, Monday through Friday. So subscribe over at iTunes or Stitcher. You can do that at tomwoodsradio.com using the subscription buttons. We'll have another episode tomorrow. We're taking Thanksgiving off. But then Friday, of course, it's the annual Black Friday announcement. If you want to give the gift of knowledge, especially to some student you know, some college student who could use a lifeline to reliable professors, or if you want to understand history and economics and philosophy better, if you want to know the real thing that most of us didn't get in school, you're going to enjoy the Black Friday offer that's coming up this Friday, and you'll hear it right here on the show. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. See you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.